Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, good news and bad news on the global health front. People in developing countries are not succumbing to infectious diseases as often as they once did, so now they're living long enough to suffer chronic illnesses that can't be prevented with a vaccination or cured with antibiotics. Thomas Boyke joins us this hour. He runs the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he will explain why sub-Saharan Africa and South and Southeast Asia have not experienced the same sort of economic gains that accompanied the shift away from widespread infectious disease deaths in the U.S. and Europe. We'll also talk about the surprising ways foreign aid efforts may need to be redirected. Our conversation starts after a short break. A development phenomenon that was repeated over and over in the 20th century. Countries that managed to get infectious disease and child mortality under control would reap the benefits of sustained financial growth starting about 20 years later. It happened in the U.S. and Europe, happened in China. Now infant mortality and infectious disease deaths are declining in Southeast Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. But that economic transformation, that has not happened yet. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thomas Boyke is director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's author of the book Plagues and the Paradox of Progress. His essay in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine is called Health Without Wealth, The Worrying Paradox of Modern Medical Miracles. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
The life expectancy in developing countries has risen to 70, which is really extraordinary. Talk about the kinds of diseases that have been brought under control that once pulled that life expectancy way down.
Yeah, so for the first time in recorded history, bacteria, viruses, other plagues and parasites, infectious diseases do not cause the majority of death or disability in any region of the world, including sub-Saharan Africa. So since 2003, the number of people dying from HIV alone has fallen by more than 40%. Deaths from malaria and tuberculosis are down by more than a quarter. And this has had a transformation. It's in particular has reduced child and infant deaths. So in 1950, there were nearly 100 countries, including almost everyone in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, where at least one out of five children died before their fifth birthday. Today, that happens nowhere.
So that's the elimination of so much needless death and human suffering. Everyone agrees that that's a good thing. Did these changes happen because of domestic policy in these developing countries or because of foreign donors and foreign aid?
It's a bit of a mix of both. So there have definitely been some local government support in implementing programs. But foreign aid and more in particular medicines are playing a much larger role than in driving these health improvements than in the past. What most people don't realize is most of the health gains in life expectancy in the United States, in fact, around 60% of our gains in life expectancy since 1870, all occurred before the widespread availability of antibiotics, before the development of most vaccines. And what we're seeing now in a lot of poor countries is it's being primarily driven by those medicines, but to a larger extent, these international aid programs leading to these reductions. And as you said, that's really good news, but it does mean that we're not necessarily seeing some of the secondary benefits that we saw to better health in the past.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, the reason that we started seeing gains in life expectancy in the U.S. before the widespread availability of vaccines and antibiotics was that, for one thing, we had better sanitation and clean water.
Yeah. So a couple of things happened, really, after trying everything else. We started to see some declines around infectious disease, first with a change in social norms, hygiene. You saw a change in practices, a little bit of what your last guest was talking about. You also saw more investment in childcare, more interest in children, not just as a resource, but as a member of the family. And you also saw a change in public health laws and sanitation. So you saw regulation of crowded tenements that grouped multiple families together. The reduction of child labor on factory floors, that was the way that tuberculosis would typically spread in work settings. You saw the pasteurization of milk. And you saw, as you said, investment in sanitation. And these are really what drove the vast majority of health improvements in the United States. And they had benefits not just because they drove health improvements, which of course means more children are surviving, means historically more women can join the workforce. They had benefits because it meant more capable governments and more infrastructure. And when you have a young adult population, the ability to take advantage of that is critical.
So, in other words, as cities take on these big public projects, they learn how to do big public projects. So they learned how to maybe do regulations of, you know, crowded housing, that sort of thing. They learned how to put in sewer systems, and then they could apply that knowledge to other infrastructure improvements.
That's exactly right. So a lot of the government measures that, frankly, we had to take because we had tried everything else. And cities were staggered under waves of yellow fever, cholera. Quarantine wasn't working. So they had to try other measures to try to reduce these public health challenges, you know, both for an economic reason, but because they were causing riots and panic amongst the population. And that meant starting to invest in other measures like these regulations to reduce overcrowding, but also in sanitation. And the investments we made in sanitation were actually the first big municipal projects that U.S. cities and English cities had ever seen. So the same strategies we used around investing in building a municipal sewer system and clean water and filtration, the referenda, the municipal bond offerings, that set the early precedent for other municipal investments in roads and railways and ports that had broader economic benefits. The same strategies we used to impose government oversight of tenements or factories are the same precedent for social regulation that governments use to introduce compulsory education. So again, we had this benefit to the population from better health, but we also had this buildup of governance and infrastructure that could allow these surviving young adults really to succeed.
So why are those kinds of changes not happening in the developing world?
So I think the assumption was that they were going to. And I think one of the major reasons we have so monitored the rate of child mortality or infectious disease in societies worldwide is because they're historically a really good indicator of progress. The economist Robert Gordon has cited infant mortality or the decline of it in the United States between 1890 and 1950 as one of the single most important facts in the history of American economic growth. China was poorer than Chad and Benin when it reduced its burden of infectious disease and child mortality in the 1950s. That allowed it to rise to great power. So I think the assumption for many people that have worked in global health and development like I have is that by having these reductions, you would see the same prosperity and well-being that came from it. And we haven't. And that's because we've become very good at reducing health challenges in deeply poor countries with dysfunctional governments and limited infrastructure, but in too many cases, they have remained deeply poor countries with dysfunctional governments and limited infrastructure.
So one other consequence, the flip side of this gain in longevity, is that people are living long enough in like Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa to develop the kind of chronic diseases that plague us in the United States later in life. Talk just about something like hypertensive heart disease in Sub-Saharan Africa these days.
Yeah, so we've seen a dramatic surge in hypertensive heart disease and diabetes in cancers in low middle income countries over the last 20 years. In Sub-Saharan Africa alone since 1990, you've seen nearly a 60% increase in deaths from hypertensive heart disease in people under the age of 59. Now, some of your listeners may say, well, that's to be expected. If people aren't going to die from malaria or from another from measles as children and infants, you're going to die of something, and that's for most people going to be these chronic diseases. The difference is that they're increasing so dramatically fast in low and middle income countries and in such young populations, and that's not something we've seen in wealthy countries before.
What might account for that very fast increase?
So primarily demography. When you have more adults, that means you have more adult health problems. Let's take Bangladesh for an example. Between 1990 and 2013, Bangladesh added 38 million young adults.
Wow.
And when you're in countries that aren't spending a lot on healthcare, so they don't have preventative care, people tend to get sick more often and present late with their health conditions, and that means they have worse outcomes and they tend to perish earlier. And it's that shift in young adults that's really driving the bulk of the increase in non-communicable diseases in poor countries. But it's also we're seeing some change in marketing of unhealthy foods and tobacco in poor countries. So on top of this big shift in having a really dramatic change in what their population looks like, you're also having a shift in diets and consumption habits on top of that that are exacerbating the problem.
So presumably people, younger adults, adults in midlife in a place like Bangladesh are not spending a lot on preventive health care because a lot of people don't have the resources to pay for it. If they did, is the infrastructure there? Are there sort of sophisticated hospital networks and clinic systems that can care for these chronic disease problems?
No, unfortunately, there isn't. And we've done a lot of investment in global health over the last 20 years, from 2003 to 2015, you've seen an increase, a 12-fold increase in how much we invest in global health aid, from roughly $3 billion to $36 billion today. And that's done an enormous amount of good. It's really driven the health gains we talked about at the outset of this segment. But it hasn't really resulted in functional health systems in poor countries. And you see a couple of impacts of that. One is the one that you referenced, is that you have young adults not being able to access a good primary healthcare system. And, you know, the average low-income country spends $23 per person per year on health. To give a more regional gloss on that, all the governments of all 48 countries in sub-Saharan Africa spend about as much on healthcare as the government of Australia, which just represents 20 million people. All people living in low and middle income countries, so that's about 6 billion people, the governments of those countries spend about as much on healthcare as the United States and Canada combined, representing around 370 million people. So you see a huge disparity in the quality of health systems and the amount of resources devoted to them.
Are people in these countries looking to move? I mean, we understand and have understood that people move for better economic opportunities. Are there people who are motivated to move by access to better healthcare abroad?
Absolutely. So people certainly do leave the country for access to better healthcare, and that happens a lot with wealthier populations. And frankly, it's a problem. Because it does remove resources from those systems, but it also removes accountability for improvements in healthcare systems. If the population that is more likely to be listened to by the government is getting their healthcare elsewhere, that results in, you know, a diminished quality in the healthcare being provided to most people at home.
So it's similar to the brain drain problem. If you let the best and brightest go because they can, those left behind are not as well positioned to make a difference.
That's right. In this case, the sickest and the wealthiest. But yes, if the sickest and the wealthiest leave, that does diminish the pressure there is to improve the domestic health system and the resources.
Thomas Boyke is my guest. He's director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book Plagues and the Paradox of Progress. He's got an essay in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine called Health Without Wealth, The Worrying Paradox of Modern Medical Miracles. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send a tweet to us at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Thomas Boyke, who directs the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations and has an essay in the current Foreign Affairs magazine called Health Without Wealth, The Worrying Paradox of Modern Medical Miracles. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. So, Tom, if there are people living to adulthood that might not have before, you have this sort of burgeoning youth population, are there enough jobs in the economies of these developing countries to accommodate all these children who survive to adulthood?
Unfortunately, there aren't. The World Bank estimates that the working age population in developing countries, low and middle income countries, will increase by 2.1 billion people by 2050. And unless national employment rates improve, that means nearly 900 million more young adults without work. Each year for the next 10 years, sub-Saharan Africa will add roughly 11 million new young adults to its workforce. And each year, sub-Saharan Africa as a region is creating about a million to some good years, 2 million formal employment jobs.
What kinds of jobs are they? How likely is it that these folks, if they have the proper skills and work ethic, can move up into the middle class if they aren't born into it?
Well, hopefully there's going to be a path for that ability to move up the economic ladder, but it'll be different than the one we've seen in the past. In the past, most countries with a fast-growing workforce of young adults put them in manufacturing. So whether that's the textile mills of 19th century Lancashire or the smartphone factories of Shenzhen today, manufacturing was the avenue in which England, the United States, and China, these countries we talked about before that had these big economic benefits from better health, this is the way they achieved it. It's really putting these young adults into the workforce. The challenge that countries improving today are facing is that they have to compete against the countries, low-wage countries, that had these health benefits in the past. So China, for instance. And that has meant, you know, for sub-Saharan Africa, again, regionally, manufacturing represents the same share of the economy today as it did in 1960. And that's just not going to do it when you have this number of people coming on the market. So the growing young adult population may be a path to prosperity for sub-Saharan African countries and some South Asian countries, but it's not going to be in manufacturing. They're going to have to find a new way.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Ben in Austin. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question is, Chris, at the beginning of the program, you said that we expect to see these changes about 20 years after infant mortality and infectious disease rates go down.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we've been talking about since 2003, which is only 15 years ago. So why is it a big deal that we haven't seen these changes yet?
Thanks for calling. What about that, Tom?
Great question, Ben. So the really dramatic improvements have happened over the last 15 to 20 years, but they've been going on for a little while. If you do get a chance to read the book, it will describe to you how there was a worldwide child survival campaign in the 1980s that achieved dramatic reductions, started to achieve the dramatic reductions we've seen in child mortality in many regions and countries like sub-Saharan Africa. It's really HIV that interrupted that progress. And it was the efforts around global health that arrested the increase of HIV and started to turn things around. But let me give you a sense of a way that you can make an apples-to-apples comparison of what we're seeing. When OECD countries, wealthy countries, reached a median life expectancy of 59, which happened way back in 1946, the GDP per capita in those countries, on average, was $4,400. When lower middle income countries reached the same threshold, again, a median life expectancy of 59, which happened in 1986, their GDP per capita was $2,200. Low income countries just hit that threshold in 2013, and their GDP per capita was $1,070. So even when you look at where other countries were at the same point in health benefits, you're talking about countries that have about one-fourth of the wealth that we've seen in the past.
Did global health advocates foresee this problem 20 or 30 years ago, recognizing that it comes tied to some to you know, achieving a goal that everyone has agreed is a good one?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think specifically around HIV, there was a fear that this epidemic, and it's really how I got started in global health and many other people got started in global health, was around HIV. And it's for me, it started in New York City and then working in South Africa and other countries in the region. And at that time, what we were fearful of was a epidemic that was really spiraling out of control. When I lived in South Africa, you had 4 million people living with HIV/AIDS, and only 10,000 people on treatment. So there was just an enormous gap. And there is a fair amount of just putting out fires in terms of how the early days of the most recent generation of global health efforts looks like to address that crisis. I think the challenge has been what's happened since. And we've continued to invest in treating these diseases because you can show progress, and that helps generate funding. It helps to show that we're making a difference in low middle income countries. What we haven't done is worried very much about what is going to happen to these children and infants as they survive to adulthood. Are we giving them that opportunity to have a healthy and productive life? And frankly, a lot of the governments for these countries haven't worried about enough about that either.
Are people who are donors to NGOs that are working in global health willing to consider redirecting the funding that they're sending overseas to pay for infrastructure, to help governments develop better governance strategies to put these things in place themselves?
Well, the good news I have for you is that people are more aware of the problem. You know, you write these books 2 or 3 years in advance, and at the time you worry, oh, this is going to sound a little counterintuitive or a criticism of the aid industry in general. And again, I am supportive of the efforts we're doing in global health. But we've arrived at a moment where really a lot of the actors in global health get it. So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation just put out a report around the UN General Assembly meetings talking about the fact that we're seeing such rapid population growth in sub-Saharan African countries that it's threatening to undo all the progress that we've seen. The World Bank has, as their central strategy to everything the World Bank is doing, is this investing more in young adults' human capital, so the quality of healthcare systems, education, and infrastructure. And they're doing that again because you have these rising populations. So there does seem to be an emerging consensus of the problem. The issue is really about what are the ways we can move this forward. How can outside actors, donors, intergovernmental institutions like the World Bank, how can we influence and inspire this change?
How does that work? Because, you know, Americans, for instance, are really excited about exporting American-style democracy, and it doesn't always work the way we hope.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, ultimately, I do think we need to recognize, and this is to some degree, the lesson of global health for the last 15 to 20 years is we can do a lot of good, but we cannot transform governments, we can't transform economies. What we can do is really two buckets of strategies that are described in the book. The first is that we can do more to create accountability for those governments to make these investments themselves. And the World Bank's project around human capital is trying to create this index that comes out every year and ranks governments' investments in the educational quality, healthcare of their own citizens. And they're trying to do that so they can link it to external financing, the money that they get from capital markets. And that's one way of creating the accountability, and it's a good idea. The second is we can embed our global health programs in a broader development strategy that starts to not just look at infectious diseases and child mortality, but is addressing, again, the need of these surviving young adults as they enter in workforce and start families of their own.
Let's go back to the phones. The number, 800-933-5372. Michael is calling us from Lakewood. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Chris. Great topic today. I'm in the renewable energy solar business, and I'm trying to tie the concept of distributed power and getting that all over the world where you can improve health outcomes. And I'm wondering about the guest's view on how that can prevent ongoing migration to megacities and keep our world distributed and keeping quality of life and standard of living perhaps in more rural agrarian communities where it isn't competing for the typical jobs of the 21st century of high-tech big city jobs. So just trying to combine the notion of distributed energy and its effect on healthcare and then development and economic and social vitality.
Thanks for calling. Tom?
Great question. So on energy security or access to energy, it's a huge issue, and it's one of the things that is talked about in the book in this piece, is that's one thing that outside actors, the private sector, the U.S. government can do is try to make it easier for companies to invest in power generation, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. That's important because, again, we need to do the things that make it easier to hire some of those 11 million young adults entering into the workforce. So it's critical that whether they move into some form of manufacturing or they move into digital services or the other things that might be the future for the region, they're going to need better infrastructure to do that, and that starts with power. One thing I do want to point out, though, it is not a bad thing that people are moving to cities. There is no country in the world that has ever become wealthy without urbanizing first. Cities make it easier to start businesses, to exchange ideas. There are economic benefits or economies of scales from living in cities. The challenge that you have in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia and some of these other very fast urbanizing regions is not that people are moving to cities, it's that they're not investing in infrastructure fast enough to support those populations.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There's always a question in cases like this where we're talking about foreign aid. There are people who think that we should provide this sort of aid, whether as you know, members of a society that sends tax dollars or people who donate to NGOs. Should we think of this as a moral obligation, or should we think of this as something that ultimately provides benefits that might in some way filter back to the rest of the world providing the aid?
So we should think of it as both. Mm-hmm. Really, there is no more impressive human achievement than the fact that statistic I mentioned about 100 countries having 1 out of 5 children die before their 5th birthday, and today having that occur nowhere is one of the signature human achievements of the last century that we've seen this shift. There's no more worthwhile activity than preventing unnecessary suffering and death in children. That's a moral obligation, and frankly, our global health budget is less than a tenth of 1% of the U.S. federal budget. We can certainly afford it, and we've done an enormous amount of good with it. It is also in our broader interest in that there are diseases that if we don't do a better job of controlling and preventing in developing countries can find their way back home. We do worry about pandemic influenza. But again, there's the recipe that I described of 2.1 billion young adults entering the workforce and only 900 million of those being without work is not a recipe for a prosperous global future. Hmm. It's dangerous. And we, those countries have an interest in getting ahead of that problem, but we have an interest in them getting ahead of that problem too.
Are birth rates in these developing countries falling commensurate to the child survival rates?
Unfortunately, not in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, or they are falling very slowly. So to give you a sense of what this looks like and have your listeners be able to have a country-specific example, let's take Niger. Niger is a country that between now and 1980 added 21 years to its life expectancy. Infant mortality has fallen 73%. The burden of infectious diseases has fallen by more than a third. But the country is poorer today than it was then. The government just spends $17 per person per year on health, and its fertility rate is virtually unchanged since 1980. And it doesn't take a math major, fortunately, to identify that when you have a dramatic reduction, a 73% reduction in child mortality, and a birth rate that is over 7 births per woman, that you're going to have a dramatically increased population. And that's what you see in countries like Niger. And that creates a young adult workforce that needs jobs, but it also creates some of the desperate migration you're seeing from sub-Saharan Africa. It's no accident that Niger is one of the countries that produces the most migrants out of the region.
So people who want to limit migration to developed countries from the developing world should think about these problems.
They should. So in 1990, fewer than a million people were leaving sub-Saharan Africa for OECD wealthy nations. In 2013, that increased to 6 million people per year. And by and large, those aren't refugees. Only 1 out of 10 of those migrants are refugees. Instead, there are people faced with the circumstances in Niger that we described. Again, a poorer country than 1980 with a much larger population. Just $17 per year on health care. Only 5 years of schooling per child, the lowest in the world. Out of the countries the UN ranks on human development, out of the 190, Niger ranks 189th. And frankly, those young adults are doing what you or I might do in those circumstances. They're leaving. And that's a problem for people that are worried about ramshackle boats going across the Mediterranean and migration. But frankly, it's a problem for sub-Saharan Africa because historically a young adult population is your future. And increasingly the future of the region is leaving.
Thomas Boyke is my guest. He's author of Plagues and the Paradox of Progress. He's also got an essay in the current Foreign Affairs magazine, Health Without Wealth, The Worrying Paradox of Modern Medical Miracles. We will take more of your calls after this break. If you'd like to get on the line, the number is 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations, Thomas Boyke. He has a book out called Plagues and the Paradox of Progress and an essay in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine on the same subject. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next on the phone to Mayer in San Antonio. Hi, Mayer.
Hi. Your speaker has already kind of covered what I was going to bring up, but maybe we can carry it a little bit further. In view of how the population in the developing countries, especially sub-Saharan Africa, is ballooning, what can we do to get our government to change their policy in terms of providing funds for sex education and contraceptive training?
Thanks for calling. Tom, any thoughts on that?
Great question. So this is really in the second basket of solutions we talked about before. Voluntary family planning has got to be top on that list. It's important for a couple reasons. One is that helping provide the contraception and promoting its use amongst women so that they can only have the children they want to have has benefits in terms of reducing that population growth we talked about, which is really important in countries like Niger, which are growing very, very fast, faster than their economy could possibly support. But it also frees women up to potentially join the workforce when they have fewer children. It also means when you have fewer children, you can invest more in the children that you have. So it's one of those great investments that can have these compound benefits. But it has been, unfortunately, even when voluntary family planning doesn't include reproductive health, so things that relate to abortion, it's many of the same NGOs that provide those services. And the fact that we shift back and forth from administration to administration, whether we're going to support these institutions is problematic for maintaining their effectiveness. Somehow we've got to figure out as a country and as people with a great interest in this outcome in the region, we have to figure out a way of doing voluntary family planning that's consistent and well-funded.
What made China able to transcend some of the problems of the enormous poverty that it had and get to the level of development that it's achieved by now in 2018?
Great. So a lot of people, you hear the circumstances in sub-Saharan Africa and you think of a country like Niger and you think this is hopeless. This is a basket case region. There's nothing to be done. And the counterexample to that is China. China, at the death of Mao in 1974, Mao Zedong, when he perished, was poorer than Niger. It was still in the midst of a cultural revolution. It was, just had emerged from a famine that had killed, depending on who you believe, 30 to 40 million people. So there are a lot of things going wrong in China. Nobody would describe governance in China as being a positive situation at the time of the death of Mao. But what they had done is they had made dramatic investments in health, really starting from after World War II, this all-out peasant-based war. And between 1960 and 1976, China added 21 years in life expectancy. Again, investing in these kinds of things that prevent children and infants from dying at the same rate. And that meant when China, 2 years after the death of Mao, started to invest in agricultural reforms, in economic reforms that started to make it possible to start those factories and those assembly line jobs, that you had this young, large adult workforce that could man those assembly lines and join those factories. And that's really what drove China's prosperity. The combination of this enormous young adult workforce and economic reforms. It's that second piece of the puzzle that we're missing in sub-Saharan Africa, but they also have some additional challenges to face that China didn't face.
All right, back to the phones at 800-933-5372. Joyce is calling us from LaGrange. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, I made it all the way to Columbus.
Okay.
but that's okay. I'm calling because I started out programming computers in 1972. And what I'm thinking is that we have portals everywhere. Most young kids, even if they don't have water, have smartphones. Why can't we train them to fulfill the large number, millions of positions, not just for coding, but for all kinds of knowledge of electronics and all kinds of things? Why can't we train them using the Internet and maybe do some video games to train them with? Because, you know, they're already playing it on smartphones in even the worst situations all over the world.
Fascinating idea. What do you think, Tom?
It's a great idea, and it's true that there's an enormous percentage of there's really good penetration in sub-Saharan African countries of smartphone use and cell phone use, particularly when you live in countries that don't have some of the hard infrastructure that you've seen. This is really a backbone to the future of the region. The challenge they have is to really build a economy around providing that kind of programming or services really depends on the quality of education. And the good news is that you have seen a dramatic improvement in schooling rates in sub-Saharan African nations, but you haven't seen that improvement in quality. So 40% of the children in the region still do not meet basic learning standards. In numeracy, about half fall short in literacy. Even in a country like Ethiopia, which is one of the fastest growing economies in the world and certainly in the region, only around one half of its fifth graders will proceed uninterrupted up to that level of schooling, and only one fifth will go on to eighth grade. And that means it's hard to build a digital-based economy providing programming if you don't have the quality education. And that's why entities like the World Bank are making such a big deal about having governments invest more in improving the quality of education.
All right. Next on the phone, we have Chantel calling from Austin. Hi, Chantel.
Hi, this is Chantel. I just had a question. Funny enough, I actually grew up in South Africa, so I am rather fond of this this show today. But I had a question about the role that microlending can play in helping maybe inspire more entrepreneurship with the youth in a lot of these countries, especially sub-Saharan Africa.
Thanks for calling.
Great question. And I, as I mentioned before, spent several years living in South Africa as well. So I share your fondness for that country and for this issue as well. There's no question entrepreneurship has to be an important part of the future of sub-Saharan African nations. Again, the region needs more jobs. And to do that, they need more investment in infrastructure, but you also need people to start more businesses. And for many of these economies, you have a really entrepreneurial population. People are getting by on informal work already, which is finding ways to sketch out a living in multiple, you know, informal jobs, whether it's selling low-end goods, depending on the season and the opportunity, or day labor. People really find a way to make it work. So it's a very entrepreneurial population. The challenge is the record that we've seen on microlending hasn't been great in terms of driving economic improvements and driving that entrepreneurialism. Now, most of the evidence we have is from South Asia, because a lot of those programs, as you probably know, started in Bangladesh. But it's you don't see that strong of a record. What people do talk a lot about, again, is educational quality, making it less burdensome in terms of regulations and starting a business. Again, trying to extend infrastructure so that people can plug into a power network. These are the things people are looking on. But you're on the right instinct that entrepreneurialism has got to be a big part of the future of sub-Saharan Africa.
My guest is Thomas Boyke, who's got a book out called Plagues and the Paradox of Progress. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tom, I've talked to people on this show who say that countries like the United States that has, a falling birth rate and net negative migration now from Mexico should actually be poised to recruit immigrants coming from places like sub-Saharan Africa. Do you think that, is there a way that we can sort of prepare to do this without deliberately contributing to the kind of brain drain problem that we talked about earlier?
Great. It's, you know, the that's the right question to be asking. Migrants built this country, obviously. The part of the challenge that sub-Saharan African countries and even South Asian countries are facing to a degree has become that it's a lot harder to migrate than it used to be. Really, when you look back at the evidence around migration, whether it's in Ireland, you know, pre-potato famine, it's really historically been driven by these health gains. And typically what happened is a lot of the young adults that couldn't be absorbed into the workforce moved, and they moved to countries like the United States, and they built our cities, they built our roads, they built our hospitals. And migrants can have that role today, but it requires, of course, policies on behalf of the United States to try to shift them to where there are work shortages, both geographically and in terms of the types of jobs, to make sure populations are being used most productively. One of the saddest things that came out, and it's talked about in the book a bit, is you would think we have this mismatch between having a large elderly population growing in the United States and the need for people to take care of that elderly population. And the sad thing is what you really see in the industry is investment in robots as a way of robots to take care of our older people. When you have, again, this dynamic of this enormous young population, and in low and middle income countries that could potentially fill these jobs that we frankly don't have enough people here to want. And I asked a leading economist studying this, and you know, his argument was that U.S. voters prefer robots. And that's a that's an unfortunate state of affairs, but there's certainly a role for these populations to play in not just building their own economy, but helping to support ours too.
I feel like there's a whole other discussion wrapped up in why Americans say they would rather be cared for by a robot than an immigrant of color.
I have to admit, I found that quote heartbreaking. To see that people would rather be isolated in that way, but it's heartbreaking for us in the United States because it says it's something unfortunate about where we are in terms of this conversation. But it's also heartbreaking for these other economies because again, this is not unusual that you're seeing migrants coming from regions that have a growing young adult population. Frankly, the history of the decline of infectious disease has been told by the migration of its beneficiaries. You can track region by region, whether it's Scandinavia in the early 19th century or again Ireland before the potato famine to England, waves of migration all happening after health improvements happened in those regions. What's happening in sub-Saharan Africa now, or even in some parts of Latin America or South Asia, is not unusual. It's the norm. What has changed is the ability of countries or ability of people to migrate to where there might be a need for labor. And that's what we're talking about here.
Do we, meaning we as a society, need to change the way we think about the metrics that measure success in health so that we're not just thinking about how long somebody lives, but about how well somebody lives?
That's right. Historically, we've really focused on, again, infectious disease, child mortality, really low levels of poverty as a way of trying to track the success of our efforts. And one of the things that we're seeing, and comes out in this book, but also in the types of conversations the Gates Foundation is now having and the World Bank is having, is that these really aren't particularly reliable indicators anymore for the broader prosperity and well-being of a population. So this investment in the World Bank to having a human capital index, all these are trying to really put a way of measuring the true progress in developing countries. And it's something that we're trying to get better at.
Thomas Boyke is director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book Plagues and the Paradox of Progress. You can read his essay in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine called Health Without Wealth. Tom, it's been really interesting. Thanks very much for making time for us.
It was great being here. Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. The Twitter handle is at KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast using your favorite podcast app and never miss an episode of Think. And you can check out what we have planned for upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.